Hello, and welcome to Unfrozen Episode 93, The Cities We Need. I'm your co-host, Greg Lindsay.
And I'm Dan Safarik. Today, our guest is Gabrielle Bendinner-Viani. She is the author of The Cities We Need, Essential Stories of Everyday Places. This is essentially, the proposition is, where would you take someone on a guided tour of your neighborhood? The two neighborhoods that we're focusing on in this book are Prospect Heights in Brooklyn and Mosswood in Oakland, California. And we're very happy to have Gabrielle on board today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So give us a little bit of an idea of what the genesis of this book was. I believe you had some kind of a postcard or photography project that eventually morphed into this book.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, so this book, I joke that I only like to work on projects that are, you know, over decades long. So this is 2 decades long project, started around about 2001, when I lived in Brooklyn and started to ask my neighbors to give me their tours of the neighborhood. I had grown up in New York, but I was new to that particular neighborhood. And I was interested in understanding, you know, what was it that I felt like this neighborhood was really special, but what was it that was meaningful to my neighbors? Also, as a photographer, I had been doing this kind of work already for quite a while in other cities, because I was interested in making photographs of cities, but also not just from the places that seemed interesting to me, but to really understand from a lived experience, what were the important places to photograph? What were the places that were important to people who spent their whole lives in that place? And so that was really how the book started. And then morphed into a much larger project, as you say, both in Brooklyn and then later in Oakland. And then thinking about, well, what does it look like to look back at those interviews and those photographs now over 20 years later? And in the meantime, doing kind of a lot of work around making this work more public. And so what were the kind of conversations that kind of archive of everydayness could help us have in this moment?
Certainly, there are shades of familiar urbanists here, including Jane Jacobs, celebrating the life on the street and the vitality of urban neighborhoods, their sheer ordinariness in some ways. So I think there's definitely precedence here. Who else did you look to in terms of your precedence for documentation or how you would approach constructing the stories?
So I think one of the things is that I've always been interested in this kind of hybridization of both, I would say, urban anthropology and photography. And so looking at both the ways in which people have been both critical of photography, so really kind of looking at photography from kind of an art historical standpoint, which really is thoughtful about photographs, what does it mean, what are framings, and, you know, the way that we construct images and the way we construct images of our world, as opposed to seeing photographs as data. So that kind of world of that intersection of thinking about creative practice and our historical focus intersecting with, you know, classic works around, you know, urbanism. And one of the things, so my PhD is in environmental psychology, which really is about, and for me, obviously looks at cities, it could look at other kinds of spaces. But environmental psychology, the kind of quick version of what that means, because most people have no idea what I'm talking about, is really that idea of taking a social science approach to people's relationships to place. And so in that context, I'm really interested both in kind of classic urbanism and research about, you know, connections to the city, belonging, all of those, and what does it look like to make and shape a neighborhood. But I'm also interested in psychology in terms of thinking about, well, what does it mean to make yourself and how are people's selves and their sense of self and place really deeply connected. And so for me, the thing that was important to me about that approach of an environmental psychology approach was kind of being able to look at all these different layers, maybe you would say, of scale of thinking about the city and thinking about people's relationship to the city. So both from the closest, from a psychological perspective of what the city does to individuals, and for individuals to thinking about culture and how it gets shaped and formed in terms of more of an anthropological look and then a broader kind of urban sociology as well. So for me, I like to kind of read across all of that work.
Well, I guess the obvious question I have then is of the various theorists out there, which are the ones you subscribe to, or which do you feel your work buttresses? Because I can hear echoes of Harvey and Lefebvre's Right to the City, things like Lynch and Alexander, and sort of the various patterns that unfold in these places, the entire placemaking discourse, obviously. So yeah, what traditions do you see this as a part of, or which ones do you reject?
Interesting. So I certainly, right, so I write a lot about the right to the city and what does that actually mean. So and I would say even before thinking about the right to the city, Lefebvre's ideas about rhythm analysis, like I'm very excited about that. But that idea of these kinds of, people who've been thinking about, well, what does it look like to kind of peel back and understand the kinds of processes of the city and that cyclical way in which they then relate to people's lives. So I'd say, obviously like Lynch and Lefebvre, all of that work, that idea. So Lynch, obviously thinking about Lynch in the terms of like the ways of like the image of the city then becomes an important piece of this, because one of the things I was always asking was people to show me their place, right? And so and then when I would photograph the places, I would then re-interview people with those photographs. And so I was always really interested in saying, people who had worked on the notion of an image of a place in relationship to it, right? So Lynch talks about the idea of the image of the city as this kind of this mental model that you have in your head that helps you understand and navigate it. I was also really interested in kind of literally when I showed people photographs of their places, how did that intersect with their own mental image of that place? So in that way, that kind of work has also been really influential to me. I would also say that idea of people who've done work on mental mapping, that kind of thing of thinking about how where those things intersect, that is one big chunk of the work that seems really important to me. But I would say another big piece of it is this kind of more Mindy Thompson Fullilove is a really great writer in this regard as well, on thinking about kind of the psychological impact of cities and cities over time and the ways in which cities' histories relate to the lived experience of people within them and how that impacts kind of people's everyday, day-to-day lives now, right? And so how the histories of city policy and obviously very segregated cities, histories of kind of the ways in which cities have been, policies have been racially structured, how that structures our experience of them now, right? And what that does to people over time and their sense of self and capacity for belonging. So Fullilove's work, she's done tons of work around that idea. And so, it's peep. So for me, I have a kind of huge body of work that I draw from, but I it's really for me it's that intersection between, thinking about, well, what is it that how do we understand the city? So that kind of body of work that's like, how do we know what we know? How do we understand the city? How do individuals understand their place within it? How do we then also think critically about how what the city is used for as production, the contrast between, the city as a tool for capitalist production versus, right, this kind of Harveyan notion of the right to the city, that the city is there to serve people, and is there for us. And then this kind of intersection of kind of a, I would say like a critical psychology point of view on thinking about, well, what does it mean then for individuals? And then what does it mean that the city really needs to do for us going forward? And so how do we also take a really critical point of view on that?
Yeah, and then over the course of the project, how have you seen these notions change? Because obviously, so much has been written particularly post-COVID discussions of the urban doom loop. Our friend Diana Lins talked about the human doom loop, where, of course, this massive decline, the antisocial century, as the Atlantic cover story put it, the declines in face-to-face interactions post-COVID, the lack of urban space. And I think there's a reflexive call in the urbanist spaces to be like, we need more third places for people. We need to get people back out into public. I know I feel that way. And I'm curious whether, in your observations in photography and interactions, whether that is true. Has there been a collapse is like a cliff falling away kind of thing like that? And can we revitalize that?
Well, I think one of the things that, so this, I had done this really extensive amount of interviewing with people about, what were their, just show me your neighborhood, right? So then I ended up with this kind of large collection of people's everyday places and what was important about them, and had been spending a lot of time thinking about, what the relationship was between people's experience and these places, over 20 years. And in 2016, I had brought the stories and the photographs from Brooklyn back to Brooklyn, because one of the things that I had noticed was, obviously the very, very rampant gentrification that had happened in the neighborhood and how many of the places that people had taken me to were missing. And it made me think, wait, I have this thing, I have this collection of work that I could actually be useful right now to help people talk about what is happening, to help people see kind of in the not very distant past, right, 10 years earlier, maybe, how much had changed. And so by using people's stories and the photographs to say, what can we do to spur a conversation about, well, is this the city we want? Is this the city we need? What's happened? It's not just the thing that went away yesterday, but let's take a little bit of a look back and see the arc of the passage of time, right? So I think that was the first moment where I thought, okay, I'm starting to understand kind of not just why I think this is important as an understanding of people and place, but also kind of what's at stake in the way that this work can act in the world. And it was in 2020, kind of in the very early months of lockdown in New York, that I'd been thinking for a long time that I wanted to turn this work into a book, but I'd always been grappling with this idea of, kind of what's at stake, why now, what does this contribute right now to the world and in a longer way? Why does it seem vital and necessary? And I'd spent a lot of time working on the Lower East Side, doing the work that became my first book, around development and long-term housing activism. So I've been thinking, this kind of everyday space and people's relationship to it, it seems sort of smaller and harder to talk about in terms of it's not splashy. But then all of a sudden in lockdown and in understanding how much people were suffering, and from both obviously fear and fear of disease and fear of death, but also that we were really suffering from not being with each other, right? And even if people were with their families or close, friends, that being kept away from strangers was actually deeply detrimental to kind of how we saw ourselves in the world. And it was really that moment that made me kind of better understand, like, okay, well, this is, I started to think back on all of these people's stories that people had told me. And it started to help me better understand and sort of figure out what was happening. And I think that that was the moment where I thought, okay, well, this makes sense as a book now, because it helps us understand why it is that this feels so terrible, why it is that what's happening feels so wrong, and that these very small things that people had described then really helped explain what was happening, in 2020, and I think to a certain extent what's still happening. And so it's funny when I talk about this book, in book talks, I talk a little bit about it as like a kind of, late pandemic moment, because it doesn't really feel like a post-pandemic moment. It still feels like, even though we are gathering that the pandemic and its impact hasn't gone away at all, really, right? Like things are changed and things are different, but the impact of that is still very much with us. And it feels like unless we really grapple with that and why those things are important, it will be very difficult to move on from that. So, I do think people are suffering from that, kind of pulling back from everyday spaces, and right, that kind of there is that larger, like that kind of the antisocial society, right? And which I thought that was an interesting piece in terms of talking about the kind of role of technology and TV and all of those pieces that have been sort of drawing us and keeping us home for a long time. But I also really like to look at it in terms of, what role has the planning of cities played in that, right? What role has the way cities have become more and more unaffordable, and most cities have become more and more unaffordable, so that, small businesses are very threatened. The places in which we kind of are able to connect and also connect across difference, right? Across class difference, seeming actually to be one of the most complicated ones within cities, that those spaces are often very, very threatened and also are hugely part of our capacity to really see each other as real three-dimensional people, and to be able to negotiate like in small ways with each other. And I think it has, it leads us to this political moment pretty directly, right? So that if we've been, over time, less and less in the same places together. And then even more so since COVID, that we don't pra have time, or we don't have these spaces to practice the kind of low stakes being together, kind of almost just talking trash, which would then allow you, when the stakes are much higher, to actually be able to have difficult conversations, right? And we are clearly in a place and in a country where we are not able to have those conversations at all. And so these kinds of spaces to me feel like it's almost less about gathering with the community who you might feel is similar to you, and more about thinking about community as what happens if we all see ourselves as having some sort of shared fate. And that's the thing that ties us together, and where we think about where are those places in which we can see that. And so that's the, for me, kind of, and why it feels like these stories and these places that, people told me about 20 years ago feel so incredibly relevant to helping us figure out kind of where we are right now.
So were there particular, I mean, you talked to probably, I don't know, over 100 individuals across both of these locations over time. Were there some individuals who you returned to over, say, a 10, 15, 20-year period to figure out how they were doing and how their stories reflected the change in the neighborhoods? And did their experiences suggest anything to you about how to repair some of these problems that you've identified?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think, I everybody who is in the book, I have, returned to over the years, and most recently before the book came out. And so I think one of the things that has been really, some of the people are still in the neighborhoods where the, I first interviewed them. Some of them were displaced or felt that they had to move around the time that I was initially interviewing them. So even in those few years, so in that experience, I've seen it. One of the things that I have seen, both from most of the people who are in the book, have come to one of the book events or another, and so that's been really delightful to have them there, and also kind of to be reflecting on their own experiences in the book and kind of since then, like in real time. One, but I would say both in those conversations with people now and in others, sort of just reflecting on the book. In a lot of the events that I've been holding around the book, I've been thinking about them as trying to do the work that the book talks about, right? Of like, how do we make spaces for these conversations? How can the book be, help be a catalyst for that? And one of the things that I think I wasn't quite prepared for is how much like grief and sadness has come out in many of these events. And I think that like how palpable and how very close to the surface that is for many, many people. And I think that to me, maybe the more than any one person's sort of story or their individual arc has been when people find themselves in these spaces where they're allowed to have conversations, how important it feels to them, how much a lot of people notice how that they are not able to have these conversations anywhere else in their lives. And I think I noticed that a lot in the kind of public art version of this in Brooklyn in 2016, that people said, you know, I just, there's nowhere else to talk about this. And it's so refreshing just to not to have to take a stance or try to argue for something, but just to be able to have a conversation. And so similarly, I think in this moment where people are saying, you know, just that idea of just being able to talk about this feels really different. And also hearing people's stories makes me feel like I'm not sure I have what those people are describing in my everyday life. And maybe I did once, but I don't have it anymore. And so I think that piece of hearing so much kind of grief from people, you know, it, you know, at celebratory events, really has underscored it for me of kind of how important and how vital kind of that, what does that look like? And how much people kind of miss it but don't yet kind of know how to get it back. So I think those pieces have been things that have really stood out for me. You know, a lot of people in the book have said, you know, oh yeah, you know, of course, I've listened to their recordings many times since then, and they're like, "Oh, I said that really?" Okay, I'm like, "Of course, it was brilliant and fantastic." But that they've said, "Yeah, wow, you know, listening to this or reading my own words really helps me remember kind of either things that I've lost or kind of have reminded me of the things that like I need to make sure that I put the energy toward either finding new places that do that, or that I don't let that feeling go by. I call all of the people that took me on these walks, I call them my tour guides. One of them is, she still lives in Brooklyn where she did, and she is advocating for, there's a soul food restaurant on Vanderbilt Avenue that's been there for a very long time called Mitchell's. And so she has been organizing to help them save their space and to help people, you know, to really kind of rally around this business. They've kind of stayed through a lot of neighborhood change and gentrification and displacement. And so she's really helping them to try and to stay there. And she said, you know, I don't know if I, you know, I've loved this place for a long time, but I'm not sure I'd be doing this particular work if it hadn't been for being part of this project, because that really planted the seeds in me to know that I need to like protect these places that I find so valuable. And I think that was very meaningful to me in terms of thinking about this book not as the solution, but as the thing that plants seeds for and reflects back to people the things that are most important in their own context and in their own neighborhoods and places to do the work that they really feel kind of called to do.
So I'm wondering if you have, you know, obviously this is told at a very granular level with, you know, a lot of individual stories, which makes it very relatable. When you step back out to a further distance of focus, what do you think? Do you see policy solutions coming out of any of this? Because we all kind of have an idea of what went off the rails, but we don't really know how to get back on.
Yes. How would you reverse engineer this back into policy? What's your prescription?
Make it
I know
better,
it's a
my
tough
God.
question. Yeah.
Yeah, and I, you know, and to a certain extent, I think I'm always kind of interested in like, well, you know, one thing that before we even get to policy, one thing that needs to shift is the way that we think about the importance of people's relationship to place and these kind of everyday places themselves, which part of the problem with working on everyday places is that even I, at certain points, I'm like, is this like actually important? We could talk about like the big things of like, you know, housing or transportation or what. And part of what I think is important about this work is to say that these are the places where people experience the policy decisions, but these are the places where people experience it on a day-to-day basis. And if we don't grapple with that, like what people experience on a granular level, then the we can kind of have all the big conversations that we want. But if we're not paying attention to what it feels like on the ground, that is a problem. And it's hard to hold on to the everyday. Like I think one of the things that about it is that it's both like it's like hard to it slips through your fingers, and that's part of the reason that I felt this need to kind of create this methodology of like asking people for walks and then returning to them with photographs that I've made, these kind of multiple ways of like holding on to something that is very ephemeral, right? But is all kind of the air that you breathe at the same time, right? It's hard to talk about because it's always there. And I think that piece of it is like, how do we shift to say that experience is not like a nice to have or a by the by, but the lived experience and the ways in which we are actually genuinely able to see each other and be with people who are different from ourselves, that is what we have. That doing that is a vital work of cities. And I think it also requires a shift to say, well, okay, what is the bottom line? What is the purpose for of cities, right? Is it the right to the city? Is it that the city should best serve the people who live there, right? That it serves all their needs as people, right? So well-being, right? Is the city about well-being or is the city about profit? Because at a certain point, it cannot be a double bottom line there. It's one or the other, because when it comes down to it, you will make a decision one way or the other, right? And we can see that so clearly. You know, I keep talking about housing, but I spend a lot of time thinking about affordable housing development as well. We can see that very clearly in that space, right? People talk about the need for affordable housing, but when it comes right down to it, almost I talk about it from a New York perspective where we have like no comprehensive idea about how to develop affordable housing across the board, right? We have all these mismatched plans. And one of the problems and one of the reasons is that the very core baseline goal there is not keeping people in affordable housing over the long term, building stable places for people to go out into the world from. That's just not the core priority for New York City. The core priority for New York City has been, and maybe that's just the way it's going to be, is profit. And affordable housing tries to fit itself into that. So we have, okay, for-profit developers who build affordable housing because they get tax breaks, and generally those things happen, you know, that those are then only for some limited amount of time, right? So it's either the one fits into the other, which will eventually be the priority. So one of the things that it feels like is like just a huge mind shift in terms of saying, okay, well, really, genuinely, will we take it? Can we take it seriously? What are cities for? And that if they're not genuinely always at its bottom line for people and people's well-being, then it's very difficult to get to being able to save these kinds of spaces, right? Or being able to value what these spaces actually do. Some of the policy stuff like that I think would change a lot of this is like not particularly rocket science, right? So many of these spaces are very like small business spaces are very at risk, right? After their 10-year commercial lease is up, you know, those rents could double. there's very little rental protection, right? So small businesses that may be the cornerstone of a neighborhood or a community don't have a lot of recourse. So there's ways in which you could say, okay, well, like you could have real rental, like residential rent protection, you could also think about the, what would that look like for small businesses, right? You could say those kinds of things would change for sure the ways in which businesses and these sorts of spaces are at risk. And that's like not a complicated idea. It's not some crazy machination, but to be able to get that done requires a shift in mindset. So some of the policy stuff to me, it feels weirdly straightforward, but to get to be able to put that into place feels like a bigger shift in the way that we think about what cities are for.
Did you notice anything that significantly I mean, people like to compare the East Coast and West Coast, and both urban theorists and, of course, rappers, like to have their rivalries. But obviously, you picked up on a lot of similarities between these neighborhoods. Was there anything distinct about the way that, I don't know, authenticity or the sort of essential humanity that you were looking for interplays with the architecture and the urban pattern that was different in Prospect Heights versus Mosswood?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, okay, so as a New Yorker, I was always, to be a certain extent, a little bit of a fish out of water in California. And so I was always genuinely really asking people for tours because I was like, I really do not understand how this whole physical environment works. And I think that that was really, it was very fascinating to me to say, like, I felt at the beginning, I felt like I was asking for those kinds of tours and to understand it in a very, very different sort of place. And I think one of the things that was surprising to me was to see the ways in which I was hearing echoes of similar kinds of stories that I had heard in Brooklyn, being told to me in places that looked very, very different, but where people were saying, this place does that same kind of work for me. And that was, I think, really interesting and important because I think sometimes, work on New York, it can feel like, well, that's just New York. Who cares? Like it's its own weird place. And one of the things that was very important to me was to see that kind of where it wasn't that the places were similar, but that they did a kind of similar work. So this idea of place work, right? That people needed to feel a sense of belonging, that there were places that help people feel a sense of self and feel a sense of freedom, but that that could happen in really quite physically different places. And it had more to do with people's interactions rather than to do with the kind of physical architecture. But one of the things I would say, obviously, you may not know, but in California, people drive. And so I think that that did really shift things. I would say one of the things that was interesting, many of the tours in California were driving with people. And so people's reach and extent of what they saw as their neighborhood was much larger, like physically, geographically larger. But I would say some of the places that people went to in that kind of spread out geography were quite, in many ways, quite similar, right? They were one of the things that I would say, one of the things that helped me understand these two places and why they made sense being compared, right? People do compare Oakland and Brooklyn in lots of different contexts, right? But one of the things that particularly between these two neighborhoods helped me kind of think about why they might be relevant to be looked at together was their kind of shared post-war urbanism, really, actually, and pre-war, right? So the ways in which kind of redlining and the HOLC kind of grades had shaped and graded these neighborhoods, and also in some ways kind of made them kind of like in between kind of red graded neighborhoods and kind of four graded neighborhoods and one or two graded neighborhoods. How these spaces had been kind of places that a lot of kind of mixing of people across these neighborhoods had been happening for a long time, And it was a big part of actually how a lot of people described these neighborhoods. But so that was rooted in urban history and in very clear policy decisions that had been made about where money had been pulled out from, right? And where it had been invested. And that there were real similarities in how that had happened in both places, yet they looked quite different. I would say one of the big differences in Oakland was that a freeway was built right through the middle of Mosfet, right? And so, not that that didn't happen in some parts of New York City or parts of Brooklyn, but or in the Bronx, right, most famously. But this happened so extensively across California cities, right? And the ways in which that was so racialized, how it was very, very clearly went through Black neighborhoods and separated people, and the ways in which that was very explicit and really stood out in people's memory and understanding of place was very important in that particular neighborhood in Oakland. And that people really still, so some of the people that I interviewed had grown up in the neighborhood and had lived there before they remembered as kids watching the freeway being built. And that experience of really seeing not just kind of like, oh, this is a street that you don't cross, but that seeing parts of your neighborhood be broken off from you multiple times in multiple ways, that was a big part of the shaping of that neighborhood in Oakland.
Well, I guess as perhaps the last question then, looking ahead, how do you expect the trajectories of these two neighborhoods or neighborhoods like them to change in, let's say, I don't know, the coming decade? I mean, we obviously have a new administration with sort of anti-urban policies. We've seen the effects of not even post-COVID, as you highlighted, and then also technology as well. Listeners know I've worked on a whole project thinking about how combination of AI and augmented reality or whatever comes after our phones will change how we see urban environments in terms of turn-by-turn directions through places and things that could guide us away from various neighborhoods. How do you think residents will continue to see their own neighborhoods? And what would you, if you had to choose, if there's a forcing function that will change the trajectory of these places, what do you think it will be?
What would I want, or what would I
That's a good question. What would you
think
want and what
it
would you think it would be? These are
would
often two very different things.
There may be two different things. Yes. Well, you know, one of the things that I think somebody said to me a while ago, they said, "So are you optimistic?" And I was like, "Did you read the book? I mean, are you living now? Like, what's happening?" But so I'm trying not to be totally pessimistic. But one of the things I do think is that what I will say, there's part of me that feels like, in some ways, COVID exposed a lot that kind of ha already was happening. And there's part of me that has this hope that it is so was so dramatic, and potentially even what we are living through right now is so dramatic that people will say, wait, we're about to burn down everything that we care about, right? Our capacity for connection. And I actually, instead of sort of living in this distracted haze, I actually need to make something be different, and I need to change something. And so that is part of my hope that may be part of what we are kind of living through. And I actually think there is some piece of that where people are realizing some of the things, like even in that kind of, you know, if we've been kind of pulling away from each other over decades, I do feel like this particular moment is making it very clear and very obvious in a way that maybe it wasn't 10 years ago, or it was only obvious to sort of people who were particularly interested in that, right? And I think, you know, that peace might be in some way a bit of a saving grace, but I think that there's all so much to say around the ways our phones take us away from where we actually physically are, right? We're never really fully 100% in the place where we are, which, you know, depending on where you are, could be a good thing, right? Or where you feel like, okay, if you feel like nobody around you is actually able to support you or accept you, that it's important to feel like you are connected to other people who might be. But at the same time, that capacity to sort of really slip away from, that notion of a shared society is, it seems to me, extremely dangerous. And so that's the thing that I find most concerning. And I feel like that's the piece of it for me that I feel like is this, like the small place that it can start from is that capacity for where is it that we have the kind of low stakes talk, that kind of low stakes sense of capacity building just to be together. So where is it that we practice that stuff? That seems kind of a huge part of the path back, right? Rather than us, kind of all going into our own atomized worlds. And so part of me is like, well, what does it look like to think about how to start those spaces or support those spaces or to see them kind of where, it's not like they don't exist. And it's not like new kinds of spaces haven't been being created now, right? So how do we notice them and pay attention to them in each of our worlds, in each of our lives, right? How do we pay attention to that and say, yeah, okay, that seems like a very small and everyday thing, but actually it's actually very important. So how do we kind of actually pay attention to that? So I think one of the things to me that seems so important right now, right? While we're apparently trying to blow up the federal government, is to say, well, what does it look like to act on a really local level? What is it both politically, but then also in people's neighborhoods? Like, what does it look like to be thinking about these very local kinds of spaces wherein sense of belonging can happen, capacity to be together can happen, all of that becomes so even much more important than it already was important in the, over the past decades.
Gabrielle, I really want to thank you for joining the podcast today. It seems that the things you're talking about, you talk these low stakes conversations are actually in quite high stakes when it comes to the survival of cities as we know them or as we would like them to continue to be. So thank you for joining us today and telling us a little bit about the cities we need, essential stories of everyday places.
Thanks so much for having me. It was wonderful talking with both of you. Thanks for your great questions.